I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 282nd installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek old and new. And tonight we are talking about Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 3, Janal. How do you say his name?
I think it's Janal.
Janal, y'all. Written by Kyle Jarro and Lauren Wilkinson, and directed by Andy Armaganian. And this is three of our 10 episodes we're getting in the final season of Discovery, so we're already 30% complete. If it was a progress bar, it would be 3/10 of the way loaded. So
it's a little unnerving, but yeah. You know, we're on, so we're in it, so no turning back.
But there's a lot to talk about in this episode. They gave us a lot of substance to chew on this week. Not like last week when they dumped two episodes on us. And it's like, mm-hmm. Oh my god, we have so much to cover. So
you say dumped? They gifted us with two episodes.
Gifted. Yeah, it's a lot of work to do in a short span of time if you're doing deep dive discussions on these episodes every week. But we're here for it. We answer the call of duty when we hear it. So. You know, we're like Rainer. It's like you couldn't even make us retire. You know, you couldn't even like force us to not do this job. So,
oh, we can act like Rainer. Oh, okay, that's awesome.
I didn't say it's always for the best, but
Father, I did not give you permission to speak freely.
Oh, sorry. The old white dude is in the room.
That's right. That's the lesson I'm taking from this. No, Well, we're obviously going to be talking about Rainer today. Several characters had kind of rough goes in this episode. He was one of them.
Got some Rainer stuff. There's even some Savru and Tarina stuff. We got some Adira and Gray stuff. But I think the star of the show, Dr. Culber, we'll cover all of that in one moment. Before we get into that, we do need to do some housekeeping. And the most important thing to do is give a huge thank you and shout out to the lovely, lovely, wonderful Text Trek Patreon supporters. So thank you so much, Starfleet, Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Daw, Geek Filter, Quark Spar, Stephanie Durantas, Matthew Averett, Braxton, Chuck A., Joel Valisok, Benginium, and our anonymous supporters. We love to have monthly watch parties and hang out with the patrons and celebrate their support every month. And if you're watching us live on Friday, we got a big one happening tomorrow on Saturday, April 13th. We're actually watching Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. That movie turns 40 this year. So it is also happens to be my favorite Star Trek film. I like many a Star Trek film. That one just happens to be the one I personally like the most. But looking forward to watching that with the patrons.
Yeah, that's going to be super fun. They're always fun, but Star Trek III is iconic, and it's gonna prompt some good talk, I'm sure.
Get to see Captain Kirk fight Doc Brown in the form of a Klingon as a planet falls apart. The apocalypse of a planet is the set piece that these two combatants fight on top of. So quite the spectacle.
One of the great scenes in it when my God, Bones, what have I done? It's such a good scene.
And we'll have some other watch party fun in May. We actually have a lot going on. So there's some bridge crew level patrons with birthdays. So there's going to be multiple watch parties. We're going to get that figured out this next week. And we'll have some more announcements on next week's show about things happening in May. But there's also a little bit of of Star Trek franchise news overall. So I guess a good news, bad news situation today on day of recording. Let's do the bad news first.
Sure.
But we found out that Star Trek Discovery is not the only season 5 of Star Trek that will be ending a show in 2024 in a few months. We don't know the exact date, but this fall, Star Trek Lower Decks will premiere its 5th and final season. Mike McMahon and Alex Kurtzman did a little thank you announcement message that they sent out today. But, you know, I've already heard rumblings of, you know, who knows, there could be possible more Lower Decks in the future. You know, I was talking to some people earlier today and I said, you know, well, as long as Titmouse saves all those animation files and, you know, these voice actors can get near some microphones and record some lines, there's no reason why we can't have a Lower Decks reunion, you know, at any point in the future. You know, there a lot of the Adult Swim animated shows that used to be on like Adult Swim like 20 years ago and they get canceled, they just like a lot of them get like revivals within like the last few years. So I think it's very likely that we'll see more of them. But yeah, that was kind of sad to see.
It is, but you know, it's like they got 5 seasons out in much less time, I guess, than Discovery did.
It's almost like old school television. It's like, yeah, we're going to premiere a new season every year in the fall. You know, it's only 10 episodes, but still, it's like at least we can be like, you know, consistent like clockwork.
Jill asks a hard Sophie's Choice question in the audience. She says, if you had to pick one to be renewed, Lower Decks or Strange New Worlds, which would
Strange
you pick?
New Worlds. Strange New Worlds.
She is torn. I'm with you. I'd pick Strange New Worlds. You know, I never fell into it. Certainly
Strange
sad
New Worlds,
to see.
I think, is the most important thing in the franchise right now. So,
well, there's you know, there's most important and there's bad or your favorite or what you like enjoy the most too. So, but yeah, even me, yeah, as everybody knows, I think I'm not a follower of it. I just didn't plug into its kind of rapid fire humor style, except occasionally. But yeah, it's like it's obviously beloved, and honestly, that's what gives me some hope that this may not be the end for it. It's just the sheer strength of the fandom.
Yeah, I mean, just last year, you know, we were watching Star Trek that had Riker and Tuvok and Ensign Roe.
Right.
I guess not an ensign anymore, but you know, I think we've not seen the last of Rutherford and Tindy and Mariner in whatever shape or form. I see Jill in the chat is asking if can we get Netflix to save it, and who knows, that might be something that we see more of as Star Trek pimped out to other streaming services outside of Paramount. Just to, I guess to talk about that for a little bit, I kind of segued into that. I wanted to get into like the good news, but I guess I'll save that with Strange New Worlds. But the Skydance deal of Skydance purchasing the controlling ownership of Paramount Global, that seems to be moving forward, although there is like some resistance now with, you know, it's going to be like a really good deal for Sherry Redstone, who basically is like, here, I have like control of this company. I'm going to sell it to the Skydance guy and let him just run it. So he wants to combine it with his company, which would increase the value of Paramount Global, and that would like decrease the shareholder value for everyone else other than Sherry Redstone, who doesn't own the majority ownership, but it has like some stakes in it. So I know this is probably getting like boring with like the business jargon, but basically there's some investors that are like, they don't want that deal, but Sherry Redstone is still pushing for it. So we'll see what happens. But I think what might be a result from that is they're talking, Skydance is talking about how like they want to keep Paramount Plus. They don't want to get rid of it. They want to supercharge it. They want to like upgrade the tech and merge it with another streaming service. So either Peacock or Max or Amazon Prime. I think Peacock's the most likely of all of those. But that would kind of work out well for the consumer in that they're not merging companies. They're just merging the streaming platform. So it's not going to be like a ton of layoffs of, you know, companies merging and stuff. But and it would just be one less streaming platform. If you have Peacock and Paramount Plus or just one or the other, it'd be like, well, we're just going to put both of those together into one package. So probably going to hike up the price. But I think that's where we're going with these streaming platforms. In a few years, there's only going to be like 4 streaming platforms, and they're all going to cost like $25 a month.
Yeah, that seems to be the general shape of things, which, you know, 25 is obnoxious, but if you're getting more services for it, maybe that's where we're going to tumble out.
Or sign up for all four of them for like $100 a month, and it would still be cheaper than... I think a lot of people today think you can get cable for less than $100 a month, because they cut the cord so long ago, they don't realize how expensive cable is, but... Anywho, but there was good news as well. Star Trek Strange New Worlds has been confirmed for a season 4, so... And I have not really, like, looked at this at all, so they might have already... I doubt they would have said much about production. They might just start shooting, like, pretty quickly after they wrap season 3. I know season 3 was delayed because of these strikes. And sometimes they do that. They shot seasons 4 and 5 of Disco back-to-back. You know, 4 was delayed because of COVID. So I think that they're going to pick up production on Strange New Worlds pretty soon. And, you know, it's interesting. I was talking about, like, oh, maybe they'll keep Lower Decks around and we can have, like, you know, live-action Trek in the spring and then animated Lower Decks in the fall. And they can just, like, alternate the Academy one year and Strange New Worlds another year. But it looks like Lower Decks will go away after this year. So I don't know if they'll want to maybe pursue another animated Star Trek show, or if they're going to have clear room to do more of Alex Kurtzman's made for streaming movies, you know, after Section 31. They want to not only do a Section 31 sequel, bring back Michelle Yeoh for a sequel to that, but they want to do other spinoffs. They want to do a Picard follow-up, you know, something with Captain Seven on the Enterprise G. I would love to watch that made for streaming movie. So
just the sense of having gotten two animated things back to back makes me think they'll back off of it a little bit with Lower Decks and Prodigy. But yeah, that's just kind of an instinct. I don't know. I guess neither of them were what you call massive hits for them. They did well, right? They've done well for streaming. But, you know, I guess there's a reason.
Five seasons is good.
Why they've hit issues.
We don't know what the, I guess, actual numbers are. But yeah, I mean, five seasons is really good for Lower Decks. So I think I would color that pretty successful. I think just shows don't have a ton of, when you keep investing money in them past five seasons, it's like, why? It's already, you know, there's already like a big thing to like sell to a streaming service. You know, there's five seasons to plug in. So why am I going to keep investing money in it now?
Right.
You know, as soon as they hit, like, those magic numbers, you know, in the old days, it was, like, around 100 episodes. When you get, like, around 100 episodes, that's why Enterprise lasted four seasons and then was canceled, because the studio was like, oh, look, we have 100 episodes. We can sell this to cable channels or whatever, and, you know, they can put it on syndication, or we can sell it to, you know, little network affiliates to, you know, show, you know, whatever, whenever they have, like, blank slots in their scheduling. And I guess now the magic number is only like three or five seasons to before you get canceled. But yeah, there really is like a trend these days of just like a lot of showrunners like not knowing if their show will end or not. And
that's,
sometimes
that's
it does.
Yeah, that's kind of brutal.
Yeah, before they can wrap up or finish or whatever. So it's like a little chaotic. But we had like the good news with Strange New Worlds. So and I guess we also learned from BBC that Scotty is going to be a regular in Strange New Worlds.
Yeah,
so
that sounds good to me. I think I probably assumed that would be the case, but yeah.
I want to see Scotty and Paley both. Well, you know, as they kind of trans, they cast such a young dude for Scotty. It's just hard to imagine how in you know
how
he 6 years chief. he's gonna be James Doohan. But
yeah, I mean that's true. But you know, I guess that's just sort of casting, you know, wankery.
But he seems like a little wet behind the ear. So not just, in, you know, in terms of appearance, like looking too youthful, but he's going to have to like grow as a character, I think.
Well, Father, the Enterprise ages you. it's a harsh mileage.
Yeah,
dude,
burning the candle at both ends, reading those technical manuals, I guess. Oh, yeah. Oh, there is another big piece of news that I don't think anyone else talked about, but I seem to be the only person excited about this movie ever. And I know y'all are like, oh, a Star Trek movie, like a theatrical movie, like those never happen anymore. But this is the one that I told y'all, like, pay attention to. But the untitled Star Trek origin story is what they're calling it now. But they added that to their slate at CineCon or whatever they call that event they just did in Vegas. But they said that the movie is on their slate for 2025. They're saying this movie will come out next year. I think it's actually going to get pushed back to 2026 for the 60th anniversary. I think they're going to want to have something then on the 60th. But they want to start shooting by the end of this year. And they have Toby Haynes set to direct. And they have that Seth Graham Smith writer dude who wrote the Lego Batman movie. And he did like the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter and some other stuff that I'm not, I can't think of off the top of my head, but I want that Andor guy directing, the Black Mirror Star Trek episode guy. I want Toby Haynes directing a Star Trek movie. And yeah. I think this is kind of like what they're describing as like an origin set decades before Star Trek 09. I think this will deal with Romulan War or formation of Federation or both. I think it'll be set, kind of a decade or less after Star Trek Enterprise. And I think they'll kind of use it as this can be like a prequel for more Kelvin movies or more prime timeline movies. They're going to use this as like, this is before the divergence point. So this is going to be a prequel to like everything, anything we're doing now going forward. But
it's weird because we don't have like a ship or a crew to hang the story on yet, right?
Right. That's why I think this one's going to happen, because they're not dealing with all the headaches of trying to get all those Kelvin actors together.
Right. It's a bunch of young ensigns that look a lot like unpaid interns.
Yeah, it'll definitely be the cheaper cast. So I think that's a big reason why the wheels are moving a lot faster on this movie than the fourth Kelvin film.
I feel like I'm always open if they've got a story to what they've got to say, but I can't say that era in particular has like a lot of interest. I feel like Enterprise hit a lot of the major beats of the origin of the Federation and everything.
I mean, there were plans. Enterprise had plans to cover things like the Romulan War and and the Federation formation. So I think that's actually a pretty fertile ground. People have been talking about making movies there since like 2005 when Enterprise got canceled.
They still got to hide the Romulans the whole time. They can't show their faces.
But that would they can show them to the audience. They just can't show them to the enemy or to the.
That is going to be a weird bit of hands tying. I don't think that.
Just put helmets on them, Rob. We know Romulans wore helmets. That's all you got to do. Like most battles are fought with like ships. Like they already explained all that. Like it's already.
I'm just saying. Like if it's a major point and they're like interacting much with Starfleet peoples, I feel like it's going to be restrictive. But okay. I'm open to people.
Dave thinks
writers.
The Toby Haynes Star Trek prequel is not going to be any good because he doesn't want Romulans in it, I think.
I don't know that that's the case, but I'm always willing to trust writers if they've got a story to tell.
Well, let's talk about this story of Janal. The official synopsis reads, "On Trill, Captain Burnham, Book, and Culber must pass a dangerous test to prove themselves worthy of the next clue. Adira reconnects with Gray, and Saru's first day as ambassador is complicated by his engagement to Tarina." But yes, on Trill, they are able to get the next clue. They now know what sector of space they need to go to find the progenitor tech, or at least find the next
clue to it.
The next map fragment. It was a little unclear on that.
I found that like any movie, including even like favorites like Raiders of the Lost Ark or something, if you poke too much at the kind of structure, the whys and wherefores they're looking for here or there, they usually tend to fall apart a bit. And so to some degree, you almost have to take a little on faith that this structure is just a fun one and they're going to bend credulity a little bit. But yeah, sometimes I'm a little, wait, why are they doing that now? But they did touch on this a little bit more, and we'll get to it, I'm sure, when we're talking about what Janal says about, why they structured it this way later on.
And Adira and Gray break up, and right. Saru learns how to balance, work with your partner, and the drama that goes with Vulcan politics.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Well, Dave, why don't you give us the first opening statement and just kind of let us know your broad impressions on the episode.
For me, this was Wilson Cruz's episode, and I was pretty all in for it. I think it's interesting how often Star Trek kind of creates science fiction scenarios where actors, get possessed by somebody, inhabit another body, something notable changes in them, Spock becomes un-Vulcanized, mind swaps, all of these, and they're all opportunities for the actors to really stretch their legs, try something different. I really enjoyed Cruz getting to stretch his legs with Janal inhabiting him. I liked seeing him living it up, but he also still had that Culber-type sincerity. So, we were talking about when he says, oh yeah, these clues that we're giving are their tests. We need to make sure people are worthy of this information. And I honestly think that's a kind of a dumb plot point. Like, there has to be better ways than making people go through an obstacle course. But because Cruise could also bring that sort of Culber-like sincerity to the moment, you know, I believed it. You know, it is a plot point I can work with. And you know, I'm still liking the treasure hunt structure, because that's a trope that I kind of like. And they're also subverting it. We talked about this in the last one. They continue to do it. Indiana Jones goes through these marketplaces and towns all the time, and chaos, and, you know, chases through them, smashing shit. But they saved the village in the first one. There was a avalanche, and they saved him from it. There was a stone artifact in episode 2 that could have been destroyed in the process of them figuring out its secrets, but they made a point to preserve it. It's a big thing. And so now we get to episode 3, and there's a big monster that they have to fight to get to where they need to get. And instead of finding it, they realize that it's not their place to encroach on its habitat, and that they need to back off and find another way, and that's the answer. So I actually really like this kind of structure of subverting pulp adventure expectations while still engaging with them in a lot of ways. It feels consistent with Starfleet's ideals, with Trek philosophy. Beyond that, I liked some of the very intentional, awkward moments of the episode, the kind of sad evolution of Adira and Gray's relationship, Saru misstepping with Tarina and getting a little manipulated by her, I guess that guy's an advisor, and Commander Raynor arguably not understanding the assignment that Burnham gave him. But I enjoyed all of those things. I don't think I really had any serious criticisms, you know, other than, treasure hunt structure can have some screwy plot points sometimes to move it forward. And I like a cool little ending. I liked Maul's little sneaky tracker sequence in the caves. So yeah, it was a win for me.
Dave, you talked a lot about the treasure hunt stories kind of having dumb contrivances before.
Yep.
And I don't know, I kind of like brushed that off as like, yeah, but you know, just all action adventure storytelling, you know, anything will have like those convenient tropes to lean on. But as I was watching this week's episode, I was like, oh yeah, Dave is right. Like, these stories really do have a lot of like dumb stuff. But I think it's really clever how Discovery is finding ways of explaining so much of that in these first three episodes. So they kind of impress me. I think, oh wow, they're leading up to something kind of dumb, but then I'll get like a line of dialogue where I'm like, that makes it go down so much easier. You know, it's like a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down kind of thing. The only like real concerning thing in this episode that stood out to me, and it's not honestly like that concerning, but just the spiritual slant they're putting on the arc. I think that kind of hit me out of left field, and I'm not sure how I'll feel about that based on what they do going forward. So I'll just have to kind of wait and see. But I love the point of the episode that they kind of sum up with Gray's monologue at the end. But I kind of like that it, you know, was an episode actually about something. And they do kind of spoon feed you the message, but they pretty much just tell you, yeah, life is a journey, and you know, there's going to be some discovery at the end. You know, we're all trying to find like that discovery, whatever it is. But as you're on this journey, you're going to have opportunities to connect with other people, and you'll connect with them based on if you choose to connect with them, or if you choose not to, and if you put in the work, and if you don't put in the work, and you will have to evaluate what connections will I have, what connections will I not have, when do I sever a connection, when do I change a connection. So it was an episode about, I guess, connecting. So it's something that Discovery tends to focus on a lot, I've noticed over the years. But we can go ahead and get into the episode breakdown, starting off at the beginning. There's some stuff at Starfleet HQ before they make the jump to Trill and kind of setting up what's going on with Burnham bringing on Raynor and also going on this mission to compete with Maul and Locke. And there's a lot of Maul talk at the beginning, and we get some a little bit of backstory.
Yeah, they managed to dig some stuff up on her, no doubt, with the basically book's information as the starting point. You'd think they would have, like, basically everybody's history in this far-flung future, but I figure after the burn and, you know, bad Emerald Chain rule and all that stuff, that maybe Data is a little dodgy.
Or there's just better privacy standards and the state doesn't keep as much documented on individuals.
You know, given the fact that there could be mysteries on the Enterprise and other than, or Enterprise, any given starship, and yes, you can ask where somebody is, but other than that, it seems like they don't always make a point that there's even cameras everywhere, unless they do need them to be there. But yeah, it feels like that maybe that privacy has made a comeback.
And we learn that we're looking for an individual Trill. We get this guy, Janal. They found that the markings left on the map piece we got in the last episode actually match we were just talking about, like, there being records on people. I guess, you know, they keep people's fingerprints on file. They keep people's Trill spots on file. So we learned that Saurian dorsal ridges are unique also. So Linus has a very unique ridge.
I heard them mention that. I guess this was... it was from somebody who got a symbiont 800 years ago, right? So in perhaps less private days, they just had to find out who was the current person, who was the current host.
Right, the Trill dots matched Janal Bix, who was the Trill who was involved with the progenitor tech in the post the chase.
Salon Trek in the comments says ACAB includes Trill Spot Registry.
Is that the... I can get behind that. Is that the same as the Trill Security that they say at the end? Like, oh, the Trill Security, they handle their own. But I don't know. Maybe they're a bit better than our Earth security forces that can be a bit Cardassian, in my opinion. Dave, you said Raynor maybe didn't understand the assignment, but we have... this is his first day as first officer on Disco also.
Yeah, I liked his awkward introduction with Michael, and her. I liked watching her very expressive face as she's trying to handle, is this a joke or is he fucking with me? Kind of, you know. it's very good work from Sinequa Martin Green, as always. But watching them, they're an unusual pairing. It's not just that, you know. Kind of, I mean, there's an age gap, there's a philosophy gap.
The age gap is intentional. He's supposed to be, he's the boomer who needs to retire, and then she's like the young millennial who's trying to, like, take over. And I guess that's
Father, is he going to say what this crew needs is to cut down on the avocado toast?
Probably. I don't think they're not going to be that ham-fisted with it. No. That's totally what they're going for.
It was interesting, you know, they we'll get to this when we get to it, but we see later on that there a little bit more of the rhyme and reason for why he did things, how he had his shorthand with his previous crew. He's a guy who doesn't like to, like, talk about his process, though.
He doesn't want to explain himself, yeah.
When he was in front of the tribunal kind of thing, he revealed he was worried about, like, losing that village to the big avalanche, but it wasn't something he was comfortable talking about, and he also thought they were, you know, they'd already made their mind up. Salon Trek says, no one wants to take orders anymore in the audience.
When we get to Trill, there's some fun stuff with Reno and Stamets and Adira. I really love the Stamets and Reno scenes. I like their friendship. I loved how, like, they didn't really get along. And I don't know, they still, like, kind of bump up against each other a lot. But Reno's sounding like a woo-woo asshole, but that what she's talking about, you know, that's life, though. You know, we come together, we drift together, we drift apart, you know, you make connections, you lose connections. She's basically like, yeah, the whole episode is about this woo-woo shit, you know. You have Janal Bix came across this thing in the 24th century, and then at the end of their existence in the 32nd century, it comes into play, but they make, like, new connections with new people they meet, and then the journey passes on to the other people. And I don't know. It's like multiple journeys converging at multiple points.
Yeah. I thought it was funny because I guess it's just Jet Reno just, she's not a very sentimental person. And so she realized she was being a little sentimental and like tried to check herself, even
like,
though
I got embarrassed.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is interesting because Stamets still seems to be kind of, he seems distracted. And I don't know if it's plot point distracted, you know, the legacy stuff he was talking about. He did, he absolutely did
mention. I think that's part of it. And also like, he was working on the Romulan tricorder that came up later in the episode when he made his discovery.
Little distracting, a little difficult. But yeah, later on he's going to talk to Commander Raynor and say, hey, this discovery could actually make the spore drive look like nothing. And we know he's thinking about legacy right now, but that has led him to not be paying the closest of attention to his, you know, essentially his kid, adopted kid. Yeah. But yeah, I like seeing that. Like, this was the first Jet Reno we've seen in this season.
Oh, right? Yeah. Yeah. We still, so we have not gotten very much Reno in the final season. I guess it was just this one scene, but I think there's more Reno. They like to save her for the back half of the seasons based on season four.
Yeah. Looking forward to, seeing her, I honestly, because I feel like she's going to be the one who's going to kind of cut through the bullshit or something on some kind of weird puzzle or just the weird nature of the treasure hunt style. She's just going to at some point be like, this is stupid. I'm like looking forward to her deflating it.
Did you look forward to seeing a Guardian Z again? Yeah, I figured we would run into him going back to Trill.
I don't have strong opinions on Guardian Z.
He's just kind of there to be the, he's just there to be like the familiar face that the audience knows and trusts. And if he says it, well, the audience will believe it, not question it too much. Because I mean, like, he's an established good guy.
Perfectly good role for a small character to be in. You know, they don't all have to have their own arc and stuff.
Need his biography. He's a weird monk dude. He's nice, but he lives in the caves with a bunch of worms.
Joel in the comments says, no talk, only riddle. which is absolutely, yes, that is his role to be like, I don't even know what I just said. Apparently you have to answer this riddle. I guess maybe he's like the Jet Reno. He's like, I didn't know that I was in a National Treasure movie. Here's the riddle, I guess.
When they get beamed down to the caves, though, this is the third time we've seen the caves of Makala. We saw it in Disco in season 3. We saw it in DS9. But this is the first time we've seen it with the AR wall. It's the best it's ever looked. You get like the sense like you're in like a massive cavern and not a set.
Yeah, it's cool. Every once in a while, I'm kind of aware of the AR wall. But most of the time, I am just I just kind of let myself get swept along by these things, and I'm just enjoying it and feeling like, oh wow, that's pretty good looking.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it the first time I watched the episode. I was just like, oh, the cave sure looks really good. And then I was thinking like, oh, it's never looked this good before. And then when I watched the second episode, I was like, oh, well, clearly, you know, the AR wall makes all the difference.
The cave is in fact my background for tonight's live stream.
I believe Dave is actually training to become a guardian, much like Gray.
Well, I'm trying on the red robes and stuff. Somebody in the comments earlier said it looked like their sleeveless outfits looked like they'd be chilly in those caves. Maybe that's part of like the monastic focus that you got to have. You got to deal with a little chilly, damp cave air.
Or maybe it's like 32nd century fabric and it just keeps you at like whatever your preferred temperature is all day.
feel like the Trill are probably pretty compassionate about their priests. They probably keep it warm.
I liked the character they created with Bix. I thought it was like a good use of Trill lore. You know, the idea of like, oh, this individual that existed in the 24th century. I get the impression that they weren't even joined. That the only reason why the very first one ever joined, that why Janal joined with Bix originally, was to pass on that important information and to be like, okay, I'm going to keep this secret and not disclose it to anyone, and you're stuck with me. And this Trill slug is just barely holding on, passed from host to host. You know, it's odd for them to live 800 years. They said in DS9 they typically only live like 500 or 600.
Yeah.
But you know, 32nd century, maybe life expectancy has gone up, and this was a bit, even by 32nd century standards, they said this is kind of odd. You know, not impossible, but kind of odd for one to live this long. But I thought it was like a cool use of Trill. Like what cool Trill shit can you do? And I guess that's part, you know, these lifetimes that can be that can be preserved like that. Kind of a little time capsule of a person. And then you wake up and you're in Wilson Cruz's body.
Yes, leading to probably the funniest line of the episode. The ooh, this guy works out.
Yeah.
But I also appreciated the kind of, I suppose, clock in a way, because we did know that this woman is old, the symbiont is old, they're both tired, they both seem to be ready to move on to their next journey in life and to pass on. They don't have a ton of time, although once the symbiont is, original host?
Early. Yeah, because Janal, the way that ritual works, the Zientara, which we've seen in Discovery before, but you can take a previous host's memories and put it in a different person, different individual.
Right. But yeah, that said, for somebody who was like ailing, I guess they got their one last lease on life. They did get a day to basically go to the park and meet some interesting people, maybe potentially get eaten by a monster and teach a lesson.
You know what it reminded me of, Dave? The original series episode, is it Return to Tomorrow? I get the Tomorrow ones mixed up. But the one with the spheres, and they have to, you know, the Risk is Our Business speech episode.
Right, right.
But do you remember when Kirk first gets possessed and he's just like so ecstatic to be in a body again, and he's just like lungs feeling with air and yeah. He's just like veins pumping with blood, and he's like all excited to be corporeal again and be in a body, and it felt a lot like that.
Yeah, that's a good connection. I like that.
And you got to think that Janal's thinking like, yeah, hopefully like this is it. Hopefully these are the real deal and I can pass out. I can hand them this little map piece thing and they don't get ate by these monsters. And anything that like I need them to prove to me, they prove to me. And then I can die and go off and be done with my mission that's lasted centuries. But
yeah, if it hadn't worked out, he'd be like, okay, I'm going to go back to bed now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess there's probably a reason to hope, though, because like kind of if they've come this far, they've got some potential.
Just real quick, before we get out of the caves and talk about what happens in the rock quarry that they love to shoot at in Star Trek Discovery, let's talk about the Adira and Gray stuff, their breakup. I am under the impression that relationship has ended. They've decided to just be friends. And
yeah, we talked a little bit about this before. Or in the first episode, or maybe beforehand.
Yeah, I said I wanted a happily ever after for some romantic pair. We were thinking it probably wouldn't be these two, just because of how young they are.
Right, right. And indeed, what we got is, you know, potentially happy in the long term, but was certainly sad in the moment. You know, even though they both were kind of finding that, basically they were kind of into their careers right now, is I guess what I would say, and discovering what they could do on their own and not as part of their very, you know, almost, you know, spiritual, magical connection they had before. But it did feel to me that, like, Adira was not quite as ready for this step as Gray was.
Yeah. And the way that they were written previously, Gray has always felt a little mature and possibly older than Adira.
Yeah,
I think if they're not the exact same age, you know, even if they are, I think Gray at least had probably more dating experience than Adira before they got together.
Yeah, that vibe fits.
Gray, who says maybe we need to change the way we're doing things. You know, there's different kinds of relationships, which I thought was kind of interesting. I thought like, oh, are they talking about like maybe we should try an open relationship or something else? I kind of like, I'm glad that the episode didn't try to spend like a lot of time on that, but I like just putting that idea out there in the universe,
right?
and kind of normalizing that. The same as like making this a very, I think, a kind of healthy breakup. Like I don't see a lot of TV shows of like teenagers or people that are just like barely above teenagers you know, like breaking up and it being kind of a healthy and good like this.
Yeah, yeah, it was good, but like still had the sadness I think it needed to have. I guess when Gray says, you know, are we breaking up, and Adira has to be the one to say yes. The look on their face, that kind of, I'm going to struggle with saying it, you know, like, but was, I thought, some really nice acting, you know. I wanted to compliment Blue DeBario on that, because that was pretty rough, and, yeah, I felt for him. It's tough to, you know, be that partner that's the one who's maybe wanting it a little bit more and is a little bit less able. But I was able to advocate for themselves and say, this is the relationship I kind of need. And if it can't be what we had, then it does need to end. And so I appreciated that's some maturity. Like you said, you know, difficult, but a mature decision.
One of the things I did not want to see in the final season Discovery was any backpedaling from the representation Discovery has been really pushing in recent years.
Yeah.
And so it was important to me that we did pick up on the Gray Adira relationship and we did see Gray again. I don't know if I'm like totally satisfied on, you know, Discovery continuing to, because I think it is, you know, kind of groundbreaking to just have characters that are non-binary or trans is still super rare in television. You know, there aren't too many TV shows other than Star Trek Discovery doing it. And it seems like there's even fewer now than there was, say, 2 or 3 years ago. Mm. So I'm hoping that Adira still has some more stuff. And I honestly, like, more substance. Like, okay, it was kind of okay to see this, but I mean, like, it doesn't really, like, add a ton of substance to the show. I want Adira to have something more important to do later in the season, I think.
Right now, what they've been doing with Adira is part of Team Tilly and Adira.
Yeah.
Which I like them. I think they're a cool pairing together.
Yeah.
You know, because that was, you know, we had Tilly and Stamets in early seasons.
Right,
but
right.
But we did talk about, there's a lot of science people on board the ship right now, and there is kind of a question of, like, oh, you know, what kind of sets... Well, any of them apart. Arguably, Stamets, now that he's not doing the spore drive, not so special. Tilly is kind of a guest starring science person who's off doing Starfleet Academy stuff. And so it would probably help be good for the show to, in some ways, show that with, like, their specialties, you know, something that is kind of only they, yeah, each one can do.
Let's give Adira a specialty. Let's give Adira something no one else can do. I mean, they kind of have that with their, because they have all the Trill memories, you know, so they can kind of do the Jadzia thing and just, you know,
yeah,
pull stuff out of their ass when they need
to. That would
to,
be cool.
I want to see more Adira. Let's give Adira something like really big on the end of the show to go out on. I think
I see in the comments that Joanne Robertson was not wild about it, said they just wanted to end the storyline, no emotional impact. You know, I disagree. I think it was, I think there was an impact, but I'll be curious to see how this tumbles out for people. Gray didn't have a ton to do in the previous season, but was what very notable,
yeah, they,
in sort of the evolution.
He got a body, and then he's like, okay, I'm leaving. I got my body, well, and I'm going to leave the ship.
There was some big stuff with Zora. The Zora thing, I think, was big. That was season 4, right? Kind of helping,
yeah,
Zora through.
Oh yeah, yeah. Gray had that whole arc with Zora. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like really key stuff for Zora, and you could argue that made Gray, you know, kind of a sub entity or like an appendage to Zora's story. But it was, you know, Gray was getting to do lots of stuff. Was doing the game to help Zora kind of focus by not focusing and stuff like that. So, but it was kind of just those scenes. And Discovery has a pretty big cast. So, you know, I can understand that, you know, not everybody can stick around.
Let's talk about the rock quarry. I don't know if this is the last time we see it. There's still 7 more episodes, so we might get back out here. You know, the Toronto crew doesn't stay away for too long. they like to shoot here, but... this was probably the weakest part of the episode for me. Just, I thought, like, the monsters are just kind of, I don't know, generic. Just like, okay, you're running from, like, an invisible CGI monster. It's not that neat of a design. You're just kind of clear CGI. But, I don't know. What did you think of the trials that they face with the monsters?
You know, I think I liked all, whenever Wilson Cruz was on screen, I thought they were, there was some really good energy to those scenes. Book and Michael, they haven't, we don't yet know where they're going to tumble out, and they don't know where they're going to tumble out. So they're just kind of being professionals right now. The one thing that I kind of thought about this scene, and I think about it, I thought about it in this, at the scene with Saru and Michael in the jungle in the previous episode, is that they're a little casual, like they're kind of out for an afternoon stroll during what I think needs to have some more energetic oomph sometimes. A little bit of that J.J. Abrams running down the hallway shit from the early Kelvin movies.
I kind of liked his, like, nonchalant attitude, though, because you could see, like, Sonequa Martin-Green getting impatient. So I thought that was kind of entertaining.
Yeah, I guess I just, like, Wilson Cruz was always killing it in this episode. but yeah, like, they're just, like, you know, I don't need to see them literally running, but that's a pretty leisurely walk. And, like, you can kind of put some energy into that if you're trying to get somewhere. And the monster, when it shows up, I think it's one of those things that was, like, it's fine. It's, you know, I could sort of tell that they wanted to do something else with it than just have him fight the monster, or they would have gone into more of like a, you know, boss fight kind of thing. You know, go for the weak spots on its shoulders, you know, or something like that. Instead,
it's
like, I was like,
how you said drones were boring to you in episode two. And like, to me, this is more boring, like a big CGI animal that wants to eat you.
I guess I pick animals slightly over drones, but. But yeah, they probably could both use some more energy. Well, but here's a question, Father. Like, it was a faster scene. Like, was the Rancor especially interesting in Return of the
Jedi? Yeah, that was a cool design. It was interesting. It had a lot more personality and character.
I mean, it was just like kind of a rampaging thing. It just growled and drooled. It didn't do much. But I think it was a straight action scene. It is lunging for you. If it catches you, it's going to eat you. And, you know, Luke had to just like real quick figure out a way to deal with it. So it's really like a shorter scene. And this was they still had to figure out the clue, but I didn't really feel like a high sense of threat to them. The stinger that went into him, they kind of took that surprisingly in stride, even though it was supposed to be painful. And when they're hiding behind the rocks talking, and Burnham is like, well, let me go out and just kind of like not be a threat. And I was like, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of territorial animals that they don't care if you're not presenting a threat. If you're nearby, a grackle will come out of the tree and attack your head. Like, well, they don't care.
She had the anthropologist insight, though. I actually really liked her saying that she was using her anthropology, because they haven't really like brought that up since the first episode. She's a xenoanthropologist.
Right. And Book also got to do his empathic animal connection thing.
Yeah.
While, you know, they were doing that. I think plot-wise, it's a solid plot point. It's just one of those things where, you know, I sometimes wish for an extra line or two of dialogue where she, you know, says something like, you know, I don't, you know, I've seen this kind of, you know, predator-prey behavior. I think that it won't hurt me if I don't go any nearer to its eggs, and so I'm going to try something crazy. You know, like, she just, like, says a little bit more to indicate where what her knowledge is doing. Beyond just animals protect their eggs, because, you know, I get that. We know that. I still kind of, I like this scene in the sense that, like, I like the overall reveal of it, that, you know, this was essentially a test of their humanity and stuff like that. That's a very Star Trek thing.
Yeah, and I was saying, I think a lot of the treasure hunt story contrivances, you know, like having these trials you put people through that seemed kind of ridiculous. I actually kind of approve of this one. It's like, okay, like this Trill was like, you know what? I'm just gonna stick around for hundreds of years and just see if I want to turn this over to the person or not. I also thought it was kind of cool to see the use of the Tricom badge when he's like, you know, and we eventually learned that the marking on the rock is a red herring. And I thought it was funny. Like, he's like, I don't even get what that means. But just how Michael could like scan it and then pull up a display of it, like right in front of her, all with her comm badge. Like, the Tricom badges are so cool. And having the portable transporter is also cool. And I did kind of roll my eyes a little bit when they're beaming all over the place with their TRICOM badges and portable transporters, you know, but then when the script needed them to not be able to beam, when they're like, oh no, we're standing between these two rocks and we can't beam. It's like, well, I think you could probably like squeeze out or something. Why don't you just try again? You know, it worked like the last four or five times you tried it, but. you know, you have to have that to tell any story. I know that the Star Trek technology will always encounter a rock that will make it stop working when the writer needs it to.
I think it was Joel in our, maybe in just some Discord comments saying something, joking that it was good to see that rocks screw up transporters in the 32nd century just as much as they did before.
Yeah, no, the writers need that. So the Starfleet Academy writers are going to need that also. So good for them.
The thing I really like when they come back and Dr. Culber, a.k.a. Janal, is just chilling on some rocks. And then he kind of like... Well, we find out some more, a little bit more along the way, too, about, like, how he was a part of a group of scientists hired by the Federation. We did find out some backstory on all that. But he asks them, is this, like, a time of peace? And, and they have to kind of try and answer honestly.
Book is quick to say, to give, like, the answer that he wants, you know? Like Book, you can tell, like, doesn't really think about it that much. He's like, oh, this guy wants to hear yes. I'm just going to tell him yes without even thinking about the question. Michael's more thoughtful.
He's in courier mode, And he's like, I got to get the job done.
Yeah, yeah.
And Burnham was a little bit more in Federation mode, and she said, it is a time of peace, that's true, but she's like, it may be tentative. What did she say? Something like, it's not peace, like, is it like a linear procedure or something like that?
Yeah.
I appreciate her honesty. It reminded me a little bit of when Pike was at that negotiation table and said... You know, you probably shouldn't take this deal in that Strange New Worlds episode when he was... I forget what he was even negotiating, but yeah, he's like, you are probably going to try and, you know, the Federation is probably going to try and exploit some this to some degree. And I was like, yeah, he needed to hear the truth to believe he was helping the right people.
When he was explaining the whole thing of, like, we found the tech... And then we buried it and lied to everyone and hit it all. I rolled my eyes hard. But when he said, like, hey, it was the Dominion War. We didn't know who we could trust. We didn't know, like, what anyone would do with that technology. I was like, okay, that makes a shitload of sense that a Federation... That is, like, the one time. And it makes sense for that to be just, a few years after that episode of The Chase. Because just a few years after that, this intergalactic task force, they found the progenitor tech... And it's the Dominion War is raging, and they don't, you know, it makes a shitload of sense why you would not bring that back to the Federation president. You either A, you don't trust the Federation and what they might do with it. B, you trust the Federation, but you think Section 31 might be in there. Or C, you trust the Federation and don't even know about Section 31, but you know that changelings do infiltrate Starfleet sometimes, so you don't want them to get their hands on the progenitor tech. It's like, you know, what do you do? Like, you know, I don't care if you're like some, you know, power hungry Romulan, you could still look at this technology would be like, okay, this is like a level of danger. I don't want it to exist in the same universe as like my children and grandchildren. I'm gonna help hide this. It really made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think so too. I kind of wanted a little bit more data about like I almost wish we had seen a side flash to his past. They said it killed one of their ally, one of the scientists of the six. And I was like, oh, you know, like. That sounded like it was some really pivotal moment or something for them. I was like, I kind of want to see that, you know, was it really horrible? Was, you know, like, was it just the violence of it that sort of galvanized, you know, how dangerous this could be? I mean, I hate to say it, but it's just one dude. that said, yeah.
Maybe
so
it was
we know
a really
they,
gruesome death that like traumatized them.
I think it must be. And so we know what they did. They took them. They tried to like clean themselves out of the databases and hide everything they'd done. And I guess they were like, we didn't find anything. But they must have gone off the grid because you know that like the Federation was not just gonna like something this vital and they just say we didn't find anything.
These guys were all really smart, you know. You gotta think they were like the brightest of the bright, so they'd be able to do it. Kind of like in The Martian when like the NASA astronauts are like hacking they don't like the orders they get from NASA and they just like hack the computer on the spaceship. It's like okay, like astronauts probably would be smart enough to do that.
Sure.
I'll believe it.
Yeah, a bunch of Richard Daystroms and all of those, yeah.
I just want to know, like, are they going to the, like, locations of, like, where that guy died? Like, are they going to, like, the coordinates of where they found the technology and where that colleague died?
I think that in the end, yes, I think so.
That's the impression I get, but I just, the structure of the season suggests that they get there and it might actually just be, like, the next one of these five map pieces they need. So.
You know, I think it's going to be the culmination, and, you know, there's interesting, like, next episode, apparently there's some place they're going into that's politically unstable, right, and is requiring, like, ambassadors to go and do some groundwork before they can just teleport in, which, when you've got a ship that can teleport anywhere, I appreciate that, you know, there's still sometimes there's some rocks that keep the transporter from working. In this case, it's the politics, yeah, which actually is more realistic than the rocks thing. But yeah, I bet I think they are going to, like, maybe get to it well before the season's end, or, you know, if at least a few episodes before. And I don't
doesn't make sense to me if they pass his test and he doesn't show them the coordinates of the progenitor technology, if he makes them go do yet another trial, that will roll my eyes if they get there next week and it's like, oh, we got to do, like, another trial and this isn't just, like, the final destination of where we're supposed to go.
Well, don't they have to do, like, I don't know, just on the sort of, like, puzzle solving level, Burnham's got two of four pieces in that thing. Yeah, Joel is saying in the comments.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Anyway, I think they've got a few more to go. But I'm betting they will get there, and it's just like, it's not one of these stories that just ends when you get to the arc. It's going to be something where, well, right, Locke and Maul got there first and they've got it, or it's not what we thought it would be, or somebody's already applying it and now we have to stop it. You're like, right, there's going to be some other beats.
The point I was trying to make was just, if he has the coordinates of the progenitor technology and that's not what he gave them, then, like, there's no reason for him not to just, well, be like, oh, here, like, I went here and my colleague died, here's the location.
Well, I mean, I think that the thing that he and the other scientists set up was a series of tests, essentially, mm-hmm, and he did his part in his test, but I don't think he's, like, the last one, so
like,
not...
he might not even, whatever agreement they came up with, this conspiracy, this cabal.
He wasn't, like, supposed to give away the final place.
Yeah, maybe he doesn't even know it. Maybe it's, like, compartmentalized. Like, he couldn't. But...
Right, maybe they selectively deleted some of their memories, okay, so that it's, like, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We've each got a piece of the puzzle.
We'll see what happens, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. I guess that I could work with that. That makes me feel a little bit better. Going into next week's episode, Janaw, I liked his concern about Kolber's safety, and I like Kolber being kind of gracious to have gotten to do that experience. I agree with you, Dave, that Wilson Cruz, it was fun getting to see him flex some more acting muscles and get out of the typical Kolber wheelhouse.
Did you see what he said about that in the Ready Room, Father, who he patterned his character after or took inspiration from?
Oh, yeah, from the old guy in City Slickers.
Jack Palance in City Slickers, yeah. A kind of one last ride, craggy-voiced old-timer. And I was like, once you see that and you go back and you look, it's like, it's all over it.
Yeah,
By the way, I've never seen City Slickers. I've seen bits and pieces, though, I know what Jack Palance
sounds
like.
Yeah, it was on cable a lot in the early 90s.
It looked like a good movie. But anyway, yeah, I do think he had a lot of fun with the role. Like you, Fathery, I'm not sure quite where the spiritual through line story is headed. He said that his abuela, that she was a doctor, but she also kept religious icons and kind of took a little bit of comfort in the idea that there's not everything has an answer, you know, que sera, sera kind of thing. And he said, I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with that. I do think, like, I said I wanted to see a discovery this season, and I think whatever, we're going to see something with the progenitors. I don't know if it'll change the face of Star Trek. I honestly want it to be more, less about, like, this super genesis technology, which was kind of how it was described by Kolber. Mm-hmm. And I want it to be more of a...
Or by Stamets.
Stamets, yeah, thank you. And more of some philosophical thing about those, you know, the progenitors and why they did what they did and how, you know, some kind of connective woo-woo thing for everybody in the galaxy. But yeah, I don't want it to necessarily be like, we've proven the existence of God, you know, it's, Or we've disproven the existence of God, or is it really God if it's just super science? I don't think that they can answer those ones satisfactorily. So I'm a little worried about where they, why they're setting up a storyline involving it, you know, where they want to find like some meaning in life. I definitely don't think, you know, I'm not a person who subscribes to the idea that there's a meaning in life. I think we have to take what value we can create, in our interactions. So, you know, I could end up philosophically opposed to what they do at the end, but, you know, I have some faith in the writers.
Let's talk about the B story with Tilly and Rainer. It bothered me, like, at the beginning of the episode when Michael is like, I'm going to need you to do some one-on-ones with the crew. It's like, I don't want to hear this corporate job jargon in my Star Trek. The one-on-one meetings he does with the personnel. But yeah, we get to see some of the crew that we only have gotten introduced like this season, like the Bajoran, Asha, or Lieutenant Gallo. But I liked the use of the bridge crew here. It didn't feel like they were being shoehorned in. You know, I complained a lot in season 4 when it's like, why do they, you know, shoehorn in these moments of just to give like the bridge crew some artificial depiction of relevance where none clearly exist, when you have Bryce just talk about like, oh, you know, it's kind of like surfing, that's how we're going to solve this problem, and it's like this, what, like,
you know what the structure of this was like for anybody who's seen, say, Armageddon. When they do the psychological tests of the bunch of like crazy roughneck people, and you get kind of pretty humorous answers of them,
or like in Discovery season 3 when Disco gets to Starfleet HQ for the first time, and they do like the debrief with everyone, they kind of do the exact same version.
It's
of
a pretty tried and true montage format.
I think that's what Reno is referencing when she's like, "Last time they gave me chips when I did this."
Oh, I didn't think about that. That's a good point.
Saurians are asexual. That's kind of cool to know, right?
Did he say asexual? I know that they reproduce asexually, I guess.
That's true. So they are not necessarily asexual in lifestyle. That's just not part of their reproduction.
They just don't have to have a mate to bear eggs. I don't know if they just happens when it happens, or
did Linus abandon those children when he came to the 32nd century with Michael Burnham? Are these eggs that he's hatched since being in the 32nd century?
I assumed that they were from those were 23rd century.
So all of his kids died hundreds of years ago without him.
Yeah, well, we haven't seen. He's probably been talking to Dr. Culber about that, or.
But they don't raise them as parents. You're raised by the community, so it actually wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Yeah, he may have had a good time reading about their exploits and adventures and their own progeny and all that stuff. So.
Yeah. The Chad is commenting on that now. That's actually quite normal for Saurian. So. I am happy we finally got an explanation for that tribble that's roaming around the ship. It's like, that I guess is Lieutenant Christopher's tribble now, that he inherited from Nilsen, who is played by the woman who used to play Arium in season 1, but then they recast Arium to kill Arium in season 2, and they let that actor play Nilsen, and then I guess, but she's out of it for season 5, so Christopher inherited the tribble, and there you go. So, you know, I know people are, like, dying to get, like, Zora and Kraft explained, and they want to know what's going on in the short Trek's Calypso, but I'm okay with that never being mentioned. I can just tell myself, oh, that was Zora's dream. The real mystery I needed answered before the end of Discovery was, why is there a tribble randomly seen on the ship? So it's...
Now
it's,
we know.
Christopher's tribble.
Unless that's a different unrelated tribble. But so the heart of that scene, I did think it was interesting. I thought it was like almost a little too comical in a way. And I was like, it's making Rainer look really bad to me. And then he did reveal that there was a method to his madness. And like, I don't think it's a good method, but that he was like finding out things about them by like whatever they put forward, kind of little, and he was doing a little Sherlock Holmesy type cold read on people where he's like, oh, well, if, you know, because he mentioned this, family is very important to Linus, and, this isn't,
He was jumping to conclusions, like a lot of older people tend to do, because they have, a lot of experience and tend to have, pretty good judgment, but because of that, they assume that they know everything, and then they become a little bit more intellectual lazy, and they stop thinking about things, they just kind of look at the surface. Right. I've seen that behavior.
And then along comes Tilly the millennial to say, I'm not gonna completely put up with this, and I'm even gonna speak out of turn. Which
you're on a new ship, fresh off a demotion, trying to hide how hard that is by being a giant, and she ran out of words.
I thought that was some nice scripting there. That's good stuff. It's funny. This does. It reminded me of the, I think he most compares with, even he's a different guy, but he most compares with, Jellicoe, who Riker said that, there's no joy when we work under, work under you. And I back then I groaned in the 80s or early 90s at that, because I was like, oh my God, dude, you're on at least quasi-military ship,
toughen up. How are you gonna tell your boss that? There's no joy working under you, sir.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess this shows maybe how far Discovery, or how far the future Starfleet has changed things. Although obviously the burn built him. He was, like a child, as if he were a child of World War II.
But it works out so well for the show. It actually makes sense for him to have an outdated perspective in the setting they've created.
Right? I think it's pretty good stuff when they got around to it. And I thought it was interesting that the episode ended kind of, not ambiguously, but without that had not been resolved. He wasn't he was able to, see where he had kind of missed the boat. Tilly at least knew where he stood, even though she was not swayed by it. And, he had not learned his lesson necessarily. Although I think he's probably will incorporate it. But do you have any predictions, Father, as to where this character is going to go? Do you think he's just going to become more chill, or is he going to be struggling more?
I've been told that Callum Keith Rennie is going around saying if there was a season 6, I would have been a regular in season 6.
Oh, interesting.
So it sounds like the arc was for him just to become the XO of the Discovery. So I don't know if that will still happen, or if maybe the things that they added in the ending, maybe they add a death and that's his big discovery at the end of his journey. They talk about the journey you're on and the connections you make along the way. Maybe the thing that he learns is that, you actually do need to have these connections and these friendships and this more intimate relationship with your crew. And maybe, he learns that and then dies. I don't want him to die, though, if anything. I know last week I was trying to recruit David Ajala onto the Starfleet Academy show. Mm-hmm. But I think, oh, my God, what a great opportunity for this character. An Academy show that has, as one of the professors on the Academy grounds, is you have the gruff old Captain Rayner, and you talk about kids talking about Captain Rayner's class, it'd be like Kirk, it'd be like you sink or you think in Lieutenant Kirk's class. I think it'd be like that with Rayner.
I hadn't thought about it, but they have already put together he and Tilly.
Yeah,
they're already bouncing off of each other, and if they find out they work well together, you might be onto something there. That's interesting.
And I think that would just be cool for the character. I think that would be a cool arc to put him on. That you don't get to be the proactive guy, out on the ship making the calls and everything. You're from an outdated era, but you still have a lot of wisdom and perspective and knowledge. So why don't you stay on the ground and teach these kids? And if you see stuff out in the stars that you think it's not right or it needs to be corrected, then you teach those kids how to correct it, and you continue to contribute through them. I think that would be a good arc for him.
I would very much like him now that you have mentioned this. And I half wonder if the fact that they made him a relatively simple makeup job, mainly ears, that would also make that's kind of a clever idea for something, so that each week you don't have to go and do the full Saru. I will say this, on a sort of realistic level, to be a captain, you have to have, I think, a certain amount of ego. And it's hard for me to imagine him, really being comfortable with the XO position or doing the, maybe even doing the teaching thing, although I could see him learning that side. But I feel like his ego has to, is going to have to bristle at becoming first officer and, you know, doing what he sees as menial tasks when he's like, I need to hunt down and track Locke and Maul. So, but I'm liking, I always like his presence, and I'm looking forward to seeing future episodes with him.
Well, before we talk about the end of the episode, let's talk about the Saru and Tarina C story. If last week was the final Saru mission on the Discovery, I guess this was the first week of seeing Ambassador Saru and what his life as a diplomat is like post his Starfleet career. I don't know, maybe we'll get him back in that Starfleet uniform someday, but... Dave, what do you think about him and Tarina, the more domestic lifestyle?
Before we get to that, I want to say I like seeing him being a pretty sly, pretty clever ambassadorial operator. He's he brokered a situation to the satisfaction of everybody involved that could have fallen apart. And so I liked seeing that he was already effective in his role. He just found out through... her assistant that there's going to be complications from it. And he hadn't, you know, necessarily thought that far ahead. I liked this. I think this is a, you know, reflects, you know, a not uncommon experience of, you know, one person being overly protective of another when that person is really pretty capable. And the more important thing is to kind of stand by, support, and represent a kind of united front. I really like this sort of sweet scenes in there. His embarrassment at being called handsome in the invitation. What do they say? Handsome and something else? Astute or something like that.
It was a word that I never say. Handsome and erudite?
Erudite, yeah, yeah.
I don't even know how to say it. I think it means like educated.
Yeah, it's...
I don't even know what it means. Like, I don't know what it means. I don't know how to say it, so I'm clearly not what it is, but...
You're fine. You're exactly right. It's just like a learned person is erudite, or if you're a good speaker and you're a clear
speaker.
That's
a good way of describing... How many languages does he speak? You know, he went to the academy and learned, like, half of the human languages. It's like, yeah, he's a bit of a academic, you know?
He is. Did they ever say, I wasn't sure if he got comfortable enough to, I thought he was going to say, by the way, you can put that back in, but that never came up again. And I was like, did they cut it or not? I want them to put it back in.
The line from the, oh, the
that he was unsure about.
Yeah. Tarina tells Duvin towards the end, like, there's going to be one minor, edit on the announcement, but,
right.
But it will go out as planned. I like seeing Saru do his thing, though, and they kind of explain, I guess, what his role is like an ambassador of multiple planets, where he's just kind of, I mean, they do like the TV version where it doesn't like go into like the detail, but it's like, oh, well, you wanted a star base, but maybe we can just like increase patrols instead. Are you okay with that? I mean, we got to run it by the president, but are all the people that he's like leading the meeting of, are they all like a president of a planet? And like, you know, Tarina is there as like president of Navarre, like everyone else is a president. And then he's like the ambassador that represents all their worlds. I assume it's something similar to that.
We know that he represents like a coalition of smaller worlds. So it's probably something like that. It was definitely meant to be kind of one of those more like, slightly symbolic of the job meetings, not like a real, you know, this was not a deep dive into parliamentary procedures. This was a, hey, it's him doing some ambassador kind of stuff. I think that's reasonable to assume.
I really liked Doug Jones's acting and the improved prosthetics where he has more expressive face acting in season 5. I really see it in the Tarina scenes. I'm sad that they didn't figure it out before season 5, but it kind of makes sense that it's like, oh, Tarina is what is making Saru more in touch with his emotions and making him more expressive. It almost was kind of a happy accident that it worked out how it did, I guess, now that I'm talking about it. But
you know, it was interesting, Father, it was like when he felt he'd overstepped his bounds, a little bit of the old Saru timidity kind of came back. And then she assured him, it's in the past. We're you know, this is kind of... She's a sort of practical person, too. And she's like, we're gonna occasionally bristle against each other, and then we're going to move on.
Yeah, and I liked the amount of grace and patience that she had with Saru.
Yeah. Yeah, they are you know, the sort of mature couples goals. I feel like I need to see them being silly or something like that. I want to see them they need to see the scene where they're in bed together and, you know, they're just close and like it's a post-coital sequence and they're just kind of giggly and having fun.
Smoking cigarettes.
They could be high. Smoking
snake leaf.
Some Vulcan stuff, yeah. You know, the Vulcans got to unwind. They put so much into the logic thing. But anyway,
See them kiss at the wedding. I think the last episode they'll have a big wedding and we'll see the big kiss then.
I don't know if you remember, but I was not particularly sold on them before. I think last season I was like, they're fine. It's okay. I'm liking it more now. I still kind of wish, I think I kind of wish Saru had been in a somewhat more passionate relationship, but as it's proceeding along, I'm liking it more and more. I like how they're handling it. I like the actress who plays Tarina, and it's like such an unusual one. You know, we usually don't get to see kind of this a quieter, more intellectual courtship too.
Yeah, you know, it's a bit unique.
Yeah, so it ends up being pretty cool.
We see a lot of characters like this, so it's fun to see a flirtation and a courtship and then, you know, full-on relationship and marriage. I think it's been fun.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, knowing that this is kind of the last hurrah for Doug Jones, it's the last season of Discovery, it's adding a certain amount of weight and like, I'm investing more emotion and extra emotion, and I need him to be happy. So I really hope it plays out well.
Well, the episode ends with Michael and Colbert talking about, you know, seeking answers and the origins of the universe and life and all that stuff. But in the Trill Caves, as Gray gives a speech about the journey of life and the connections we form, we see Maul infiltrate the Guardians and plant a tracking device, I assume, on Adira.
Yeah, tracking device is what I would guess, but who knows?
So Maul and Locke.
Maybe it's a bomb, just gonna blow the Enterprise to Discovery to pieces.
The Discovery. You're like a pack lead in Lower Decks. You want to call every ship and every show? It's the Enterprise.
Like shut up.
Whenever the Sarita shows up, they're like, "Look, it's the Enterprise."
It is the Enterprise. They're all the same. They have the same look.
And every woman captain they call Janeway.
It's all the Star Trek Enterprise.
But yeah, so it's a safe assumption. We're getting to some Zenkethi space next week, and Maul and Locke are going to follow the ship there. I'm hoping we get more Maul and Locke next week, though, because all we got was one close-up of Maul. I take that back. The episode opens with a bit of backstory. We get like a three or four lines of exposition, and then it ends with a close-up of her. So it's kind of bookended on Maul. Locke is nowhere to be seen. But how do you feel about that?
It's a trope to show somebody who you don't know is like a one of the bad guys, and they're walking by, and then they do something that reveals themselves. And it's a trope I like. I was like, oh, she's cool. Like, she's sly. You must have worked pretty hard to get inside these super secret caves on Trill. And so I liked it as a good little cliffhanger.
I was hoping that we would learn more about them this episode. But one of my fears, I guess, is if they draw out the mysteries on Maul and Locke. It's like, we're also relieved that, you know, that they don't have like the mystery box mystery going on of what's the larger arc about, what's the larger story about, what are these characters searching for? But I guess I'm now instead worried about the Maul and Locke stuff getting drawn out. But I'm having fun speculating. They mentioned the brain.
I don't mind it being drawn out. I'm not in a super hurry to see them answered.
You can kind of like write yourself into a corner if you start like making the mystery a big deal. You start having like the characters be like, well, what do we actually know about this guy and stuff? And then like it turns out to be something kind of lame. It can be disappointing. And Discovery's done that to us before.
Father, were you about to mention, I have become aware of this theory, this something about the brain.
Well, they keep mentioning the Breen. This is the third episode in a row they've brought up the Breen. Yep. So I think, if nothing else, the Breen are set up to be the... I keep talking about the Academy show. I need to talk about Discovery and not Academy. But are they setting the Breen up to be the Klingons of Starfleet Academy? I think that's likely. You know, I keep wondering, who are the threats now without the Emerald Chain? So I liked them mentioning the Tholians and the Breen and then the Orions again last week. But the Breen come up the most. And we know that... Locke does not like wearing a helmet. We know that no one knows what he is, and the Breens are supposed to be mysteries, so maybe he's just an unmasked Breen.
That's the theory I have heard. I don't know if I've heard any more details about, like, how it would all, what the idea is, but I think that's an interesting one, and that would be, like the Breen could use some fleshing out. They were just a scary force, I'd be down for it. I'm at least open to the idea for sure. You know, hopefully they've got a good story to tell with it.
It's also possible that he's a Zenkethi, I guess.
What's that?
Well, that's the species that they're going to next week.
Okay.
I got something fun for that in the Gornegs, I guess. But okay. We don't know anything about them in canon. We don't know what they look like either. But I guess the people in Starfleet would know. Like, they wouldn't be like, oh, we have no idea what Locke is. So, yeah, I guess he's not a Zenkethi.
Yeah, that's true. Where have we seen them before, though?
Deep Space Nine, they're mentioned, but not seen. But there is a war with them. They were a big, powerful, scary race to go up against because they were so terrified of the Dominion going there. I'm sorry. They were so terrified of the Defiant going there and starting a war when that changeling on the Defiant took over and was he was going to basically drive the Defiant to Zenkethi space and start fighting them and war between the Federation and another war between the Federation and Zenkethi, because there was one shortly before Next Generation and DS9. The Federation was at war with the Cardassians, they were at war with the Zenkethi, so I like to think it's the same war. And you can also throw in the people from Suddenly Human, but we've never seen one, so
yeah, they've got some options, and I imagine that they wanted to have a few options on the table so that nobody was just like, I'm 100% sure of my theory. And that's good. In a show like this, you do need to have some ambiguity at times because people will be theorizing about everything. So I think that actually is important to do.
Speaking of that, one last theory, and then this is all I got to say before the Gornegs. But I was thinking last week that there might be a moment when Book has his moment of temptation. What Stamets is saying now about the progenitor tech could possibly be used to reanimate the dead. I think at some point Book is going to be offered hey, you come help Maul and Locke get the progenitor tech and we can bring back Quajon, we can bring back Leto, we can bring back your family. And you're going to have to see Book make that choice. Is he going to betray Michael again, or is he going to stay on her side? I think he's going to be tested.
I think that's a good notion, Fathery. I laughed for a minute just imagining he goes off with them, and it's an exact recreation of the previous season with Burnham stop it, Book, and he's like, I don't want another Quajon, and they just recreate it almost exactly. But no, there's obviously a serious trauma to
It's going to be their excuse of why he doesn't have to do community service anymore. It's going to be see, look how clearly reformed he is. He had the opportunity to do the same thing again, and he rejected it. So.
Yeah, I think that makes some sense. Also, by the way, you know what they should do with the progenitor's tech? They should hand it off to other dimensional Tarka and his boyfriend in the universe that they now inhabit.
Yeah, I don't think Tarka made it over there. I think
then hand it off to the other guy.
I think that dude is fried, but
the other guy might have had less sort of dangerous ideas floating around in his head about rekindling things.
We'll see what happens with the progenitor tech.
I am a little worried. I'll say this. There's a little fear of the usual Discovery thing of the burn ending or kind of dissatisfying elements of Control and the Red Angel yes, we do know broadly what they're looking for, but when they get there, it's the kind of thing that Discovery has been known to drop the ball on. So fingers crossed for you, Discovery.
Yeah, I think they actually stuck the landing pretty good with season four. So
I can agree with that. I can agree with that. They also have it within them to stick the landing.
I'll say this: I'm really liking the season three episodes in, but I was also this impressed three episodes into Picard season two.
Right.
So and you weren't you didn't fall for Picard season two like I did early on. So, but I don't know. Discovery season five seems to be working on both of us. So I think it might know what it's doing. Yeah. We'll find
out.
And
I also I'm a little bit aware that I'm a little sentimental about Discovery at this point. And so if this had been season five, but I knew there were going to be two more, could be that I might come down a little harsher on some of it, but
it makes it special that, like, what we got with Doug Jones last week, what we got with Wilson Cruz this week, it really does make it more special.
Yeah, I'm liking, I'm really, if people aren't watching The Ready Room, recommend it. There's all kinds of good stuff coming out in these conversations, and actors are kind of, in a lot of ways, doing farewells and reminiscing about some of the, you know, some of the really amazing times. Doug Jones is talking about being excited about taking those leg extender hoof things off. but like, it's really sweet. There's actually, like, a lot of great stuff in every episode of Ready Room. So
Let's move on to the Gornegg section of the show. This is where I like to talk about the Easter eggs, end jokes, and continuity connections that we thought were worth mentioning. But the episode opens with the reveal of a USS Lockerer. I assume that was named after J.P. Lockerer, the camera operator who passed away, worked on the show in previous seasons. Also in the Federation member meeting, we see what appears to be a Soleil.
Oh.
But the Soleil were a reptilian species introduced in the Next Generation episode Lonely Among Us. And I really liked the modern version. It's still kind of the same Cobra head, except red instead of green. But kind of
looks cool.
Yeah, kind of just kind of an improved version of the old shape. You know, I guess the face looks a bit more snake-like. But yeah, I like it a lot. Yeah, I like it much more than the... and I love Strange New Worlds, but I like the Disco Soleil much more than the Strange New Worlds Gorn.
I agree with that.
Next up, I liked this one. This was a fun deep cut. Tarina's shrewd political operator assistant, Duvin, said that making that announcement would be, at that current time, would be like adding a spark to a keg of cabrodyne. Did I say that? Cabrodyne? That was the substance used in the explosives and the bombs in Keiko's school in the Hand of the Prophets when the Bajorans were bombing her school for teaching cosmology and not, like, intelligent design.
Right.
She's, like, teaching evolution.
Right, and they're, like, the Bajoran fundamentalist doctor.
So I'm glad to know that that stuff, the Cabrodyne still around in the 32nd century. I also really loved Dr. Pollard's response to Captain Rayner during her one-on-one when she said, "The worst thing I have ever seen in the sickbay was a Binar with a Decalan boar worm eating its synaptic processor." We know the Binar from the TNG episode 101101, whatever, it has like ones and zeros in it.
Yeah.
But that planet, the Darkalan boar worm, Darkala was the rogue planet from the Enterprise episode Rogue Planet, where those hunters were hunting the slugs that Archer kissed one of them when it turned into a woman.
Yep. Very dark planet out there.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Also, Saru uses the saying, "To rush a Saylot is to risk a Goring." That was a fun animated series reference to the
Have we ever seen a live action depiction of a Saylot?
You haven't seen it yet, but when we get to Enterprise season 4,
nice.
I mean, live action, it's CGI, but
sure. But yeah, that's what I meant too.
But it's on screen next to Scott Bakula and Julian Blaylock. So
that sounds dope.
We got some Sluggo Cola. I think they just reused the prop that they made for Picard season 3. Someone shipped it up from LA to Toronto to get it on Discovery. But Sluggo Cola also survives the 32nd century. And I guess that Ferengi at the bar in Discovery is named Red. They call that bar Reds. So I guess it has a name. And we get those coordinates from Janal and learn that they are in Zenkethi space. So that's why the Federation has to send in ambassadors, because the Zenkethi, I guess, still have some rough relations with the Federation. But yeah, those were people that, like, Sisko said, like, war with them was, like, really terrible, and I hope we never have to go to war with them again. I'm excited about next week's episode taking place in their space. I hope we learn about the Zenkethi. I don't know what they'll show us, if we'll see one, or if we'll learn anything about them, but I'm hoping that there's something. We get some Zenkethi lore. I've been wanting to learn about them for like 25 years, so I'm ready.
The day has come.
And that's all I got on Gornegg's. I'd be curious what people think about this episode, though. Y'all heard Dave and I talk about it for an hour and a half, so folks should comment on YouTube, or you can reply to my tweets. I put out tweets asking people for their opinions on new episodes each week, or you can join the Text Trek Discord server and talk to us there. and we might share your responses next week. Dave has some subspace transmissions we received from last week's two episode premiere. So, Dave, what are people saying about Red Directive and Under the Twin Moons?
Yeah, yeah. People responding to those first two episodes. First, we got from Facebook, Tom Casey says, "For what it's worth, I thought the first two episodes were bang up job. Very well done. Going to miss this show, but I know it's got its haters, but it was okay for me. It got me to go to Vegas." And notes, it'll be weird this year meeting actors this time around. Little farewells to some of them, or at least short-term farewells. From Blue Sky, let's see, Trek Wars says, "Loved it, love the direction. This gives me the feeling of The Force Awakens in the best way possible. The pacing is extraordinary, and it is fun, fluffy Trek with the deep emotional core." Does note, way better than, like, the disastrous season that was season two.
Oh, by the way, Trek Wars is a podcast that compares, like, a Star Trek and Star Wars. They're, like, watching all of it in release order, and they're also based in Austin, Texas.
Oh, so that's, like, their specific thing. Okay, yeah. That's very cool. I'm going to throw out a few from YouTube. Opinions no one cares about will frequently kind of live stream some thoughts, and I thought I had a few fun ones from there. So let's see. So here's a few. An alien who rose to captain in Starfleet and then becomes an ambassador. Saru's taking the Spock career path, I see. He's even in love with a Vulcan.
Mm.
Also says, the question is, which episode will Rayner have his sympathetic dipshit from Chicago backstory moment? 4? I'm going with 4. So we'll find out in about a week.
Nice.
I thought this was an interesting one. Rayner said he was involved in 7 Red Directives and was point on 4 of them. How often are they a thing? Because, yeah, that's apparently these, like, kill, don't stun directives were common enough. Now he's got to have a career stretching decades. And it was in the era of the post-burn, pre-disco. So I guess things have been pretty rough, but apparently that's common enough. And then here's just a more general thought. I'm a little apprehensive that they seem to be taking the chase and trying to stretch the plot across an entire season. And that, we'll just have to kind of wait and see on, I think. But reasonable fear. Last one I've got is from Discord. Joel, frequent poster Joel, also was kind of live posting responses and said... talking about the clue that they got from the, the stone that had the Romulan 5-line poetry, mm-hmm. says the clue is like the staff of Ra from Raiders. Maul and Locke only have the front piece and are digging in the wrong place, which we did talk about last week a little bit. But yeah, that's it. That's our subspace transmissions. Thanks, everybody. I look forward to seeing some more next week.
Yeah, and people should chime in if you have thoughts on Janal, like I said, and we might work it into the show next week. When we talk about Season 5, Episode 4, Face the Strange, I'm going to end the show with Michelle Paradise's tease. She gave us a little tease for every episode in the final season. On Episode 4, she says, mind-bending and exciting, and a heck of a lot of fun. So mind-bending and exciting. Is Zenkethi space? Is there like some weird, trippy, mind-bending stuff going on in their space? I think it might get weird. The episode is called Face the Strange. So I think we're going to have some weird, trippy stuff.
Father, do you happen to have handy what the description was for this week's episode?
She said Dr. Kolber, as you've never seen him before.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That was a nice bit of understatement. I'm enjoying these, Father. I'm glad you're doing her little hints and
are fun.
Teases.
So who knows? Maybe we'll get Michelle on the show someday. She doesn't do any podcasts. I've never seen her in like in interviews.
So
but
cool.
We're gonna get. I have so many questions for her. No one talks about her. I feel like I'm the only one with questions for her. So Michelle, I'm trying to find you. I'm trying to get a hold of you. So. We'll work on that. But looking forward to episode 4 next week. Please watch the first reaction streams with Rachel on Thursdays. Dave and I will be back Friday with the deep dive discussion. Listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.